बस एक जन से फौज को कुछ नहीं मिलता, बट दे राउंड अप प्रोफेसर्स एंड सम स्टूडेंट्स एंड बेसिकली शॉट देम आउट ऑफ हैंड दैट नाइट, एंड समटाइम्स विद इन ईयर शॉट इफ नॉट विद इन साइट ऑफ देयर फैमिली दे गो टू, आई मीन ढाका यूनिवर्सिटी, लॉट ऑफ द professors, lot of the faculty accommodation was in multi-story buildings. So they'd go to those buildings, cordon the building off, go into the houses, ask for people on a list, right? Drag them out into the courtyard and shoot quarters. They just went into rural areas and killed all men between, you know, of military age, between the ages of 16 right. and 55 or something like that. I mean, they just slaughtered them. And sometimes they'd sort of pull off their lungis and, you know, carry out a cursory check if they'd been circumcised, and that was sometimes enough to go on a shooting spree. History is not simple. History is not black and white. And I think in the Indian, Indians are smart people, but we are fed a black and white story a little too. And I think that, like, there are lessons from the lead up to the Bangladesh war, right? From the things that Pakistan did wrong in the lead up before the shooting started. Right? Right. There are some lessons for us in for how we treat the shooting.
So welcome on the show, Shri sir. This is an honor to have you on the show and talk about your book. I'll just show the book first, December in Dhaka. Firstly, this is such a pretty cover for a non-fiction book. I absolutely, when I first got the book from HarperCollins, I was like, oh my God, they have cracked the, you know, cover wala thing, because non-fictions don't usually have that masala wala cover. And this has exactly that, the yellow beautiful cover with the whole texture and everything. So, firstly, sir, congratulations on the new book. Talk Thank to you. Me about the new book. How did you, you know, come up with this idea to write about the 71 war? Because there are a lot of books about this topic. So, please share some thoughts on that.
Happy to. First of all, thank you for having me on your podcast, Jay. It's equally an honor for me. I belong to an older generation, not as familiar with social media as your generation. So I'm always glad to to sort of speak to people from your generation. So how did I come to think about and write this? I was a schoolboy at the time of the 71 war. So both my father and gentleman who became my father-in-law, both were in the Air Force, both participated actively in the war.
Right.
We were living in Delhi at the time, and a lot of people around us also participated very actively in the war. So I would say, you know, from the age of 12, 13 onwards, I've had a huge volume of stories of Right. little stories from, you know, people whom I used to address as uncle, and you know, they had done incredible things during the war. So right from that age, I had a lot of these stories in my head. And as I grew older, and then for many years I lived outside India, I began to see that India treats and remembers its military history in some ways very differently from the rest of the world. And I was very puzzled about that, and I realized that people outside India had, particularly in Western countries, in North America and Western Europe, they had very little idea, first of all, of India's participation in the two world wars.
Right.
They had no idea that India had put 1.5 million men into the field in the First World War, and 2.5 million 25 lakh people into the Second World War, which that was at a time when India's population was about one quarter what it is today. So, if you sort of normalize, it's the equivalent of putting, 10 lakh people into the war today, out of today's population. So it started with, my realization around those. And I've written a book on the Second World War, as you on India's contribution to the Second World War.
The Forgotten Few?
The Forgotten Few, correct.
Yeah.
So, and in respect of the 71 war, I think what amazed me was that the 71 war was in many ways a bit of a special war in some ways. It was one of the first, in the period from the end of the Second World War to about the period of the 71 war, the world had divided into these two camps, the the Western NATO-dominated camp and the Warsaw Pact Soviet Union-dominated camp. And there had been several wars or short conflicts during which Western-supported allies equipped with Western equipment had clashed with Soviet-equipped and Soviet-allied countries. I mean, there was a there was a clash across the Taiwan Straits between Taiwan and China in the 1950s. There was the Vietnam War, where one side was using Russian equipment. There was the Korean War, then and the Vietnam War, in both of which cases one side was using Soviet equipment, the other side was using Western equipment. And in nearly every case, the side using Soviet equipment did not succeed in its war aims. So the 71 war was in some ways the first major war in which the side using largely Soviet equipment, although we also had some British equipment, our side, we were largely using Soviet equipment and a little bit of British equipment. We actually outfought an enemy which was largely American equipped. And so I think that is a change in the narrative. That is a change in a global narrative, which I now understand that the that in many ways the Western narrative didn't want to change. They didn't want to acknowledge the extent of India's victory. So without getting into conspiracy theories about Westerners always want to keep India down, which I don't believe, by the way. I think it's fair to say that the Western the military industrial complex didn't want to highlight a war in which Soviet equipment had come out looking
makes
so
sense,
good.
Makes sense,
So I think those were all factors which made me more eager to tell the story. And in recent years, in the last 10 or 15 years, I've also become very conscious of the extent to which India herself, I think, has not always remembered the 71 war for the right reasons. Last year, the year 2021, we had a countrywide sort of celebration of the 1971 victory. We called it Swarnim Vijay Varsh, and there were lots of events all around the country and a lot of honoring of former war heroes and veterans and so on. And all that is very, very good. But I think a lot of that, I mean, treating it as a celebration and celebrating those undoubtedly very honorable heroes is only a part of the story. And there is a much more important part to the 1971 story in particular, which I think last year we didn't mention at all. And I think it needs to be brought out more.
Right.
So since you've read my book, you'll be aware that the shooting war part actually only occupies the middle 50-60% of the book. I mean, there's a preliminary part which covers the lead up to the war, and what I feel is an important part which comes afterwards, which tells what happened after the war and contributes to why, in my view, we are not remembering it for the right reasons.
Right. So what I also feel is that when we look at two wars, like the 71 war and the Kargil war, we also see this narrative that comes out through Bollywood. There are a lot of films on Kargil war, but there are no films on 71 war. I think so there will be one now on Sam Manekshaw's life, but apart from that, there's no real film on that. And that also shows that somehow we have forgotten that war. But coming to the part of war, how did this war start? Like, was it because of the election and the Awami League not getting its rights, or was it because of the language movement which started in 1951, where Urdu was made the national language and Bengali was not even looked at? So what was the whole reason behind this?
I think both of those factors were very important contributors, Jay. Obviously, the language movement started in the 1950s, started quite soon after the creation of Pakistan. And I think it was from a Pakistani point of view, it was a genuinely ill-advised step that Jinnah and the largely West Pakistan-dominated government of Pakistan took to, they, like India also in many ways, immediately on independence, there was a very crying need to unite. Both India and Pakistan are actually very diverse countries, right? Both India and Pakistan have, we have huge populations which speak multiple different languages and have different cultures. And even in West Pakistan, the culture of the Sindhis and the culture of the Punjabis and the culture of the Northwest Frontier Province, just now Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, those cultures are all quite different, right? The languages are different. And East Pakistan was predominantly Bengali-speaking region. You and I know how proud the Bengalis are of their culture, of their language. And, you know, it was a very ill-advised step. You know, again, I can understand that there was a need for Pakistan to unite its entire population and feel part of a single nation. But that language, that driving Urdu down the throats of all the communities was a hugely ill-advised move in Pakistan, and particularly in East Pakistan. So that started very early. There were also a lot of structural economic discrimination between East Pakistan and West Pakistan. There's some of that in my book, but there's a lot of very good economic studies about those contributors. And, West Pakistan, which had much less than half the population of the combined Pakistan, consistently received more than 60% of the investment. And there were ways in which profits of East Pakistani companies, jute companies and export companies, were shipped to the West and credited into Western bank accounts. So that was another major factor. And then towards the around 1970 and 71, two other things happened. One is there was a very bad cyclone that hit Bangladesh, and the relief measures were very badly handled. The relief measures were mostly under the control of the West Pakistan-dominated government. They were very badly handled. Right. And then there were, as you said, there were elections in December 1970, which was won by the East Pakistan-based Awami League on a scale which probably even they didn't anticipate. Swept the seats in the East, and that was enough to give them an overall majority of over 50% in the combined parliament. And the West Pakistani parties, led, I have to say, by Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, just refused to let that happen. They just dug in. There was no earthly legal or political reason, when I say political, I mean constitution. They didn't have a constitution at that time, but justifiable reason to avoid calling the parliament and allowing them to choose a prime minister. But everyone in West Pakistan knew that if they did that, the prime minister would be Sheikh Mujibur Rahman of East Pakistan at that time, and they just weren't prepared to allow that. So I think these are all huge factors, which by March 1971 had made the path to war almost inevitable. If there hadn't, unless there had been someone of Gandhian stature in West Pakistan to say no, the results are in, and we must honor the results. There wasn't anyone of that standing.
Yeah. And what makes your book special is that it talks about not only one aspect of the war, but several aspects. Like, it talks about the army, air force, navy, and it also talks about the diplomacy. And there were a lot of track one, track two diplomacy that was going on at that time. So can you also talk about that aspect? Because everyone knows, okay, war happened, so obviously there will be the role of army, air force and navy, but diplomacy, everyone forgets that. And India was fighting a diplomatic war at UN for Bangladesh. Yeah. So can you talk about that?
So, as you say, Jay, there was a diplomatic battle that was going on in parallel with the military operation.
Yeah.
And what made that crucial, I think, is partly that, India has, right from independence onwards, India has actually always gone out of its way to respect the UN, to be a significant contributing partner to the UN. We participated in UN missions of all kinds. We've contributed UN, we've contributed experts in various development related disciplines to the UN. And we are actually, in terms of national representation, there's a very, very large number of Indians in the UN. Yeah. In fact, we keep breaching the UN has nationality quotas, right? And we keep breaching them because there are so many Indians in the UN. So we've always wanted to work through the UN. We've always wanted the UN to work with us. Now, what happened in the at the time of the 71 war, or in the year up to the 71 war, there's another major geopolitical event that was happening. At that time, remember, China was largely diplomatically isolated. They didn't have relations with the Western world, and they were not remotely as important to the Western world's economies as they are today. Today, they are the manufacturing center of the world. Every Western multinational in the world has manufacturing facilities in, or outsourced contract facilities in China. That wasn't true then. The West was totally isolated from China. China was just beginning to emerge from the Chinese Civil War between Chinese communists and the Chinese nationalists. The nationalists had been thrown out and they migrated to Taiwan. Taiwan still held the China seat in the United Nations until very shortly before the 71 war. Now, what was happening, and which was at that time a deep, dark secret, was that the president of the US at that time was, of course, Richard Nixon, and his national become his secretary of state, which is the equivalent of foreign minister, was Henry Kissinger, who is a, you know, still alive, still a, you know, treated with enormous respect, although he bears responsibility for a lot of the worst historical disasters in the last 50, 60 years. But he was the national security advisor of the US, and he and Richard Nixon had started a secret outreach to China, because they saw that as the big accomplishment of that their government was going to be. They were going to be the government that had broken down the the lack of contact between the West and China, not out of any altruistic reasons. The reason they wanted to reach out to China was they were bitter enemies of the Soviet Union, and by that time China and the Soviet Union had started having differences. So, you know, my enemy's enemy is my friend. That was the principle they were pursuing. And so they had started a secret outreach to China. Now, that secret outreach to China was very, very difficult because China had no diplomatic representation in the US. The US had no diplomatic representation in China. So they had to work through an intermediary country. And as it happens, the intermediary country which had relations with both the US and with China was Pakistan.
Right.
So they were working through Pakistan. They were dependent on Pakistan to bring off this this new diplomatic connection and rapprochement between the United States and China, and they didn't want to risk that. So for that reason, during that period, they were bending over backwards to accommodate Pakistan's concerns and to do what Yahya Khan, who was then the Chief Martial Law Administrator of Pakistan, whatever he wanted. So that was another, very, very large diplomatic factor. So because the United States was clearly bent on supporting Pakistan, you know, no matter what Pakistan did, no matter what horrendous crimes, war crimes Pakistan was committing, the United States was bent on supporting them. And so for that reason, it was extremely important for India to have some kind of diplomatic cover. So late in 1971, we signed this Treaty of Peace, Friendship, and Cooperation with the Soviet Union. And the understanding was that the Soviet Union would, as far as possible, veto actions in the United Nations which ran counter to India's interests. And without those Russian vetoes, India would have been stopped before the war ended. And because as soon as the war started, the US descended on the United Nations and started all the energy of its diplomatic corps. It tried to whip the entire general body of the United Nations, the General Assembly of the United Nations, into passing resolutions to stop the war immediately and return to pre-war positions. Now, this formulation, stop the fighting and return to pre-war positions, is a very standard UN formulation when they're trying to stop a war. But in the case of this war in particular, if they had done that, stop the war and return to pre-war positions, that would effectively have been gifting it to Pakistan.
Right.
Because Pakistan had not been able to make any inroads into Indian territory. Right? All the inroads are being made by India into East Pakistani territory.
East Pakistan.
So if that resolution saying stop the war and return to pre-war positions had gone through, India would have had to give up all the military gains it had. And if that had happened before we reached Dhaka and got Pakistan to sign a surrender agreement in Dhaka, it would not have been a victory. We would not have been able to show it as victory. And God knows what would have happened, after we'd stopped fighting.
Yeah.
So it was touch and go, because 2 days before we reached Dhaka, there was actually a resolution on the floor of the United Nations, which, if it had passed, would have stopped us at that point before we reached Dhaka. Just 2 days before we reached Dhaka.
And in fact, like I was telling you before we started this interview, that I talked to a lot of people and I asked them, like, do you have any specific doubts about anything that you want to ask? And one thing which constantly keeps coming up is the decision that India always takes of going to UN. Like in 47, we saw Mr. Nehru going to the UN for the Kashmir issue. And if a lot of people think that that was a mistake, and for Bangladesh, we again saw that. Do you also think that going to UN was a mistake?
I'd like to make a point here. During the 71 war, we didn't actually go to the UN and ask them to intervene. Everybody else went to the UN and said, stop India, stop India right now. Right?
Okay, so it was the other way around.
It was the other way around. It is not that we went to the UN and we were having a hard time because we went to the UN, not at all. Right? Mm. We did not go to the UN. Everybody else, in particular Pakistan and the United States, was camping at the UN and trying to get India to stop the war. And if they had managed to get one, they actually managed to get a resolution through the General Assembly of the UN, where all the 105 or 110 countries at that time, they managed to get a resolution through the General Assembly saying India should stop the war. And that resolution passed with something like, 90 odd in favor and just less than 10 against. So that was very much a diplomatic defeat for India, because we could not persuade, with all the evidence we had of Pakistani atrocities in East Pakistan, there actually was a resolution which passed in the General Assembly of all the countries, in which overwhelmingly the General Assembly of the United Nations voted against us and voted. Basically, they said stop the war and go back to pre-war positions. Now, we were lucky that was a General Assembly resolution. And at that time, General Assembly resolutions are not binding on member countries, right? Security Council resolutions are binding. Right?
Yeah.
But in the Security Council, we were being protected by the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union was vetoing every... The Americans kept coming up proposals to stop the war, but the Soviet Union was vetoing those up to that point in time. Up to about 2 days before we reached Dhaka. So as I say, we had by a huge margin lost that vote in the General Assembly, which I think has to be treated as a diplomatic defeat for India, although it was not binding on India. But in the Security Council, thanks to the treaty that Mrs. Gandhi had signed with the Soviet Union, we were being protected. But the Soviet Union could not continue that indefinitely, because the Soviet Union also has, they have multiple relationships with the rest of the world. They didn't want to damage their relationships with other countries which might have had an inclination towards Pakistan, Turkey and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and many of those countries, they have good relations with the Soviet Union as well as with Pakistan. And so the Soviet Union had, they didn't tell us, but what happened was 2 days before the end of the war, 2 days before two days before the army actually made it into Dhaka, there was a Polish resolution introduced. Poland was at that time a non-permanent member of the Security Council. So there was a Polish resolution introduced to stop the war. Now, Poland at that time was a Warsaw Pact country. Right? So there is no way that Poland would have introduced that resolution without having quietly discussed it with the Soviet Union in advance. Right? So there is a very good chance that if that Security Council resolution had actually been put to the vote, there's a very good chance that the Soviet Union would not have. They were already putting pressure on India, saying we can't keep this up indefinitely. You've got to do something. Right? And they were hoping we'd stop with about with part of the country under India's control and set up a government in exile in that part of the country or something like that. Nobody anticipated that we'd take over the whole country. The Indian army would run over the entirety of the Army, Air Force, and Navy would run over the entirety of Bangladesh in such a short period of time. Yeah. And so, as I say, 2 days before we reached Dhaka, this Polish resolution was introduced. If it had passed, we would have been in deep diplomatic trouble, right? Because we would have basically had to give up all the military gains that we had made. And we were saved because Zulfikar Ali Bhutto threw a tantrum on the floor of the United Nations. And he tore up the resolution and said, I will not be a party to the breakup of my country. And he stormed out. He was play acting for his own political reasons. Right? Yeah. But because he did that, in effect, that Polish resolution was never put to the vote.
Wow.
So it was there was a lot of drama going on in the UN as well as outside Dhaka.
Right. And as you rightly mentioned that no one was actually assuming that India would take over the whole country. And apart from that, we actually gave the whole country to the Bangladeshi people and we came out. We went in fast, we came out fast. And that was the speciality of that war. And we'll also talk about that. But before that, how did this war became India's war? Because from March, I think so, Pakistan had started their atrocities or whatever we want to call that. And India went in December. Early December. So till then, I am assuming that India was preparing for the war and there was a huge refugee crisis, like around 10 million Bangladeshis were knocking on the doors of India. So
came into India.
Okay, they just came into India.
Came into India, not just knocking on the doors, they came in.
So was the refugee crisis the main reason behind India going in?
It was a very, very significant reason for India going in. I don't think we... to be fair to I don't think anyone in the Indian government actually saw this as mauka mila, Pakistan ko kuch dikhane ka. I don't think anyone was really, you look at the original cabinet minutes and discussion papers, many of which are now publicly available, there is no sense that we were seeing it that way. We were, we were overwhelmed by the, by the humanitarian crisis. We wanted the humanitarian crisis stopped. We wanted the refugees returned safely and in conditions of dignity to Bangladesh. To do so, it we did try pushing a number of non-military solutions, none of which could be made to work. So finally, I think we came to the view that we had to go to war. Now, it's also fair to say that you mentioned that the Indian Army went in early December, and that's accurate in many ways. But fighting had started. Shooting between the BSF and the Indian Army on the Indian side and the Pakistan Army on the Bangladesh side had actually started by late October. And at that time, it was mostly BSF. It was the BSF actually stepped up and did brilliantly during the run-up to the 71 war. They manned the border extremely effectively. They strengthened their positions. They worked side by side with the army. There was very little of this home ministry, defense ministry, arguments at that time. They cooperated very well. The head of the BSF at that time was a gentleman by the name of Rustamji, right? Like Manekshaw or Parsi. So you will find an occasional article here and there saying that it really helped that both Rustamji and Manekshaw were Parsi. Our minorities did so brilliantly during that war. Everyone you look at, so many of our, of our most successful commanders in the war were from minorities like the Parsis, the Jews. General Jacob was a Jew. General Arora is technically a minority, he's a Sikh. So anyway, that's a whole different discussion. So my point is, a little bit of shooting had between the sides had started as early as October, and by November it had become more serious. And by around 20th of November, by 19th, 20th of November, some very serious shooting, including a small number of tanks, were in action in some parts of the border between India and what became Bangladesh. And that's why that first dogfight, which was such a so widely reported, front page headlines in all Indian newspapers, that dogfight actually took place on the 22nd of November, where India, the first where Indian NATs first shot down Pakistani sabers, and we captured two of the pilots. We captured two of the Pakistani pilots. So
this is
the
Boira dogfight.
Correct. That's the one I'm referring to. That happened on 22nd November. So it happened before 3rd of December. 3rd of December was the date that the Pakistan Air Force carried out a series of what they thought would be preemptive strikes on Indian air bases. I mean, just a few years earlier, 1967, the Israeli Air Force had carried out a preemptive strike on mainly Egyptian and other Arab air bases, and succeeded brilliantly in knocking out most of the Arab air forces even before the rest of the shooting started. So Pakistan thought they would be able to reproduce that, and they called it Operation Genghis Khan. And they launched attacks on a number of Indian air bases with the objective of reproducing that preemptive strike. Didn't work. We lost hardly anything. We lost maybe one aircraft in out of the 10 or 11 places that the Pakistanis attacked. Neither side, neither India nor Pakistan, had precision weapons at that time. They carried out that first attack in the evening. And you know what North Indian winter evenings are like. It's hazy. It's very difficult to actually identify small targets and something like that. So it didn't succeed. But that is the date from which we normally start the start of the war. But it's fair to say that there'd been some fighting and shooting even before then.
So I actually wanted to cover like the three main parts of this war. One, you know, like three: Navy, Air Force, and Army. And I was going to actually talk to you about the Boira dogfight, but before I come to that point, I actually want to talk about General Tikka Khan, because he's known as the Butcher. And what kind of atrocities were made by Pakistan? Can you talk about that? Because there's still a debate about the numbers, but if you can, you know, just give a general idea of that.
Sure. I think there's a debate not only about the numbers. I mean, the debate about the numbers is the most visible. But generally, you know, in one of the challenges to writing a decent history of India-Pakistan conflicts is that the results are always, you know, the word is contested. It's very hard to come up with reasonably reconcilable accounts of the same battle from the Pakistani side and the Indian side. By now, for a lot of the World War, First World War and Second World War battles, and in many other wars also, by now, the two sides have got to the point where they can come up with broadly reconcilable accounts. In India-Pakistan wars, they're nearly always contested. And Pakistan always has a version which is different from the Indian version. So that is a challenge. But to so they contest the pretty much universal accounts of what happened of the atrocities that were carried out in Bangladesh. But basically, what happened was they started what they called a crackdown, a military crackdown, on the 25th of March, which is the date that Bangladesh now treats as its Independence Day. So the Pakistani army started that night. They had tripled their manpower strength in East Pakistan before then. They'd spent
Searchlight, right?
Yes, this is Operation Searchlight. So this is so before Operation Searchlight started, they had tripled the number of men they had on the ground in East Pakistan, and they shipped a lot more. They'd sent a lot of their troops by civil air, without their weapons, and they'd sent weapons by sea. And the weapons are being unloaded in Chittagong by Bengali laborers, and it was the Bengali dock laborers who were unloading all the weapons who gave some of the early warnings to the Mukti Bahini, or the Mukti Forge as they were then, that arms are being brought in and something is going to happen very definitely. So on the 25th of March, the Pakistan army started its crackdown with all these troops and weapons that they brought in and pre-positioned. And it was very organized, and they had different areas allocated, different commanders and all that. So on the first night itself, one of the things they did was they went to Dhaka University and they rounded up a lot of university professors and students whom they felt were pro independence for Bangladesh. And without any, there was no form of trial or anything like that, but they rounded up professors and some students and basically shot them out of hand that night. And sometimes within earshot, if not within sight of their families, they'd go to Dhaka University, a lot of the professors, a lot of the faculty accommodation was in multi-story buildings. So they'd go to those buildings, cordon the building off, go into the houses, ask for people on a list, right? Drag them out into the courtyard and shoot them. Okay. So they started by going after what they saw as the intellectual sort of drivers of the Bengali independence, of the Bangladeshi independence movement. And then they started going after ordinary people. There were areas in Dhaka which were considered to be hotbeds of this independence movement. Right. And they basically went into those areas and they flattened those areas. They bulldozed those areas flat. Right? And there are photographs of that period, which are really scary, because those areas that they bulldozed were basically the poorer areas. Right? So suddenly the poorer areas, which were crammed, you know, sort of jugi jompli type structures, right, crammed close together, had been bulldozed flat. And around them, there were multi-story, there were, you know, more formal constructions which were left untouched. Right? Okay. And then so they start, they were, then they went into the countryside, and they started killing people almost at random. At that point, they started, you know, they were no longer looking for people who were sort of declared to be independence supporters. They just went into rural areas and killed all men between, you know, of military age, between the ages of 16 and 55 or something like that. And they just slaughtered them. And sometimes they'd sort of pull off their lungis and, you know, carry out a cursory check if they'd been circumcised. And you know, you know, that was sometimes enough to you know, to go on a shooting spree. So it was horrendous. Now the numbers are like so much else about the wars between India and Pakistan. The number of civilian casualties is disputed. The Bangladesh government says 3 million, as you know. The Pakistan's Hamdur Rahman Commission report, which is aside from this number, is a broadly honest analysis of what Pakistan did wrong, carried out by a former Chief Justice of the Pakistan Supreme Court. It's quite unsparing in its judgments of what Pakistan did wrong, but it comes down with an unbelievably low number of about 25,000. Right. Right? Right. Now, somewhere between these two is the truth. Right? Yeah. And it is almost impossible today to actually do a detailed forensic investigation which will establish an exact number. But a lot of independent third parties say that it's definitely in the hundreds of thousands, running up to definitely lakhs of people, running up to maybe 10 lakhs, which would be 1 million. So that 1 million is somewhere between 25,000 and 3 million, which are the two extremes, you know, acknowledged by Pakistan.
So it was basically a Holocaust.
It was a Holocaust. I mean, the word Holocaust is appropriate in this in this context. Absolutely appropriate. That word has been misused many times, but in this context, it is absolutely appropriate.
Right. Got it. So, you know, on this channel, we talk to a lot of ex-Indian Army personnel. And I know for a fact that there are a lot of students who are, you know, aspiring for CDS and everything, all the army exams. And they would love to know about the actual missions that the Indian military took on. So talking about the name, and also I would recommend people to read this book, because how brilliantly you have written this, you know, specific missions that the military took. Like, for example, the Boira dogfight. I literally had goosebumps at that moment. The war diaries, especially the paratrooper segment. And apart from that, the Navy operations, the Karachi operations. You know, I would absolutely recommend everyone to read this book for those chapters. And let's talk about the Navy. Like, we also know that Navy actually had, it was like the backup of India. It was the backbone of India in that war. So let's talk about the Karachi mission. Can you tell the people what exactly happened over there?
So I think, you know, Pakistan's Navy is very much a one base Navy. Right? It's the only really major naval base that Pakistan had was Karachi. So the Pakistan Navy was concentrated in and around Karachi, and the Indian Navy was determined to sort of to hit Karachi very, very hard as early as possible during the war. In fact, right. they actually wanted to do it on the first day of the war. But as you know, after the Pakistani strike on Indian airfields, it took the Indian, Mrs. Gandhi wasn't in Delhi at the time. She was flying back to Delhi and she was on the way. And she landed at Delhi maybe 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. I don't remember the exact time. And technically to declare war, she had to get the president's signature, President V.V. Giri's signature. So by the time V.V. Giri's signature was obtained, it was already, it was too late to actually launch the Karachi raid that night. So they start, they launched it. The ships that were to participate in the first strike, they basically launched the following day. So it was a little, it was a day or two later than the Navy had intended. The Navy always intended to strike Karachi hard as possible, as early as possible during the war. So now what they did, the other interesting thing is at that time, you know, most warships, certainly at the level of technology that India and Pakistan were using, most warships carried guns, heavy guns, right? And that was their primary armament. In the few years prior to the 71 war, in the early and mid 1960s, both on in the West as well as in the Soviet Union, anti-ship missiles had started to become a much more reliable weapon.
Right. Right.
And the Soviet Union had developed this concept of missile boats, which are very small ships. I mean, 200 tons. I mean, to give you, to put that in perspective, the Vikrant, the flagship of the Indian Navy at that time, her displacement somewhere between 16,000 and 20,000 tons. 16,000 and 20,000 tons. The next two biggest ships at that time were the INS Mysore and the INS Delhi. Both were in the region of 8,000 to 10,000 tons. Right. Now the missile boats were 200 tons. They're little boats with, you know, one or two officers and a crew of, you know, maybe 10, 15 sailors, things like that. And, you know, small boats like that don't have great range. But these missile boats, the Soviet Union had designed these missile boats, each of them carried four anti-ship missiles. And that those four anti-ship missiles can really throw a tremendous punch. Right? So, but the drawback of these 200-ton boats is they don't have the range to go, get from Bombay to Karachi. Right?
Yeah.
So what did the Navy do? The Navy developed a technique to tow them. So each task force that went out to Karachi consisted of a couple of larger ships, mostly either the Russian Petya class or the Talwar class, which are old British World War II era ships. And they're about 2,500 ton ships. So they towed the 200-ton missile boats until they were within a relatively short range of Karachi, and then they cast them loose and the missile boats went in. And there's a lot of very exciting detail, because these missile boats were captained by young lieutenants and lieutenant commanders. The captain was a lieutenant commander, the executive officer would be a lieutenant, there'd be two or three officers and 15 sailors on each ship. They had been working up in Russia till just about a few months previously, and then the missile boats have been brought back to India. They were brought back as deck cargo, right? And they were landed at Calcutta, because at that time Calcutta had heavier duty cranes than Bombay. Right? So they were brought to Calcutta and put into the water. They were brought back as deck cargo on bigger cargo ships, and then put into the water in Calcutta. And then the Indian Navy practiced the towing technique and towed them around from Calcutta around to Bombay. And they've been training for this. They've been practicing for this. They knew what to do. They'd done an exercise, a month or so previously in the Arabian Sea, in which they'd knocked out a target which was beyond the horizon. So they went right into, they approached to within a few kilometers, literally, of Karachi Harbor the first time, and let fly. And they succeeded, I think, in some ways, even more brilliantly. There was a surprise factor. There was the Pakistanis literally did not know what hit them.
Yeah.
And they saw the missiles, they saw the trails of the missiles coming, and they mistook them for aircraft.
Wow.
The Pakistanis who glimpsed the missiles coming in all thought they were under attack by aircraft. So there was a surprise factor also. No one expected it. So and the first attack was brilliantly successful. And then 2 days later, they followed up with another. And in the second attack, which they actually sailed almost into the harbor. They didn't need to go that close because the missile range is enough to fire from outside. But there was a degree of Josh and daring around around those two operations. That really makes for terrific reading, and I hope someone does a full length book just on those operations. And and as a there is an article floating around somewhere among the in the services circles by a contemporary naval officer. He writes that you know anyone who goes through the story of those two attacks, right, all they want in their careers in the Navy is to have an opportunity to do something like that.
Wow.
So it's a fantastic story. And it,
And
it was brilliantly successful.
So I remember I was doing this one podcast with Lieutenant Commander Bijay Nair, and he was commissioned into Navy much later, but he talked about this these two missions, and these were his inspiration to get into Navy. So I totally agree with you on that. And then, you know, coming to the Indian Army, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, he just before his arrest, he gives a speech, I think it's on radio, where he tells people to come out and fight the Pakistani army. And from there, Mukti Bahini more or less is born from that one speech, and Indian Army helps Mukti Bahini. So I want to talk about two missions of Indian Army. One is obviously how they train the Mukti Bahini, how they help them. And the second one is the paratrooper mission, because in the book you have written a war diary, and that is just brilliant. So can you talk about these two things?
I think the training of young Mukti Yodhas to make them into effective soldiers, it started months before the actual shooting war began. So to that extent, I think it's fair to say that we were preparing for the war quite a long time before the shooting started. And the Bangladeshis had very little military, there was very, very low representation of East Pakistanis in the Pakistani armed forces. So when the Pakistani crackdown started, obviously a lot of the Bengali origin officers and men deserted immediately and formed themselves into fighting units to resist the Pakistani army. But the numbers were very, very small. So they weren't enough to mount a serious threat to the Pakistan army formations that were in East Pakistan at that time. So the training that the Indian Army provided to young Bengali men who were willing to undertake that training was a very, very important force multiplier, right? And there were numerous camps established on the Indian side of the border where this training was carried out, and instructors used to go to the refugee camps and look for young and reasonably fit looking men. Most of them were half starved at that time, but they looked for young men with potential, and most of them put on a lot of weight during their training because they were put on a regime of good food and lots of exercise very early during the training. It's not so much an Indian Army story, it's an Indian Navy story, but it's a worthwhile, but it tells much the same story. There's this book called Operation X by the journalist Sandeep Unnithan, who's himself the son of a naval officer.
Right?
So Operation X tells a story of how the Indian Navy went around and from among these young Bangladeshi refugees, they picked a small number of fit young men and train them as divers. They train them and not with any great equipment, frogman's equipment like you see in films and things like that, but just train them to swim in open water, even if there's a current of up to about 1 knot, and carry limpet mines with which to knock out ships. And that is another sort of little story about the Seventh Point War, which is really a it's a wonderful story. And they were mostly Bangladeshi young men who were sent into back into East Pakistan to carry out these operations. But the process of picking them up from the refugee camps and training them, feeding them, putting them through exercise, training them in the skills necessary. That's very similar to what was done to the Mukti Yodhas by the Indian Army. And I don't know of a book that sets it out in so much detail by the Army, but Sandeep Unnithan's book on Operation X is a very good description of much the same kind of activities carried out by the Navy. And a small number of Indian Navy diving instructors went back into Bangladesh, into East Pakistan, as it was then, before the war actually started, to just shepherd these young men, in what they were doing. And they should have got much higher decoration than they did. In many cases, we were a little reluctant to talk too much about what they did because they started doing it before the formal start of the war.
So those
training operations were an enormous force multiplier for the Bangladeshi and Indian sides. And the parachute assault, and that's it's quite a fascinating story. I think the Indian Army in many ways, I think one of the contributors to that operation is that the Indian Army senior officers in 1971 were all veterans of World War II. So they had all sort of grown up, when they were young men and young officers, they had trained in the techniques that were used in World War II. Many of them had participated very successfully in World War II operation. So they were very, their thinking was oriented very much towards the kind of operation that made a big success of World War II. And in World War II, parachute-borne assaults were incredibly successful on both sides. The Germans captured the island of Crete in the Mediterranean using almost purely airborne troops. Later in the war, D-Day started with parachute assaults by the Allies. Arnhem, the operation which is known for the, through the film A Bridge Too Far, was a massive airborne and parachute-borne assault. So I think the parachute brigade of the Indian Army was very keen to participate somehow in a large an airborne assault. Now, the reality is when the fighting actually started in the east, the army made such fast progress that some of the ideas that the Indian Army had had for the use of the parachute units were overtaken because the Indian Army on the ground was moving so fast.
But
the one place where they did where they did come in useful, again, it was phenomenally successful. It was about the parachute drop was about battalion strength, so that is less than 1,000 paratroopers. But it took about 50 odd aircraft to carry those 1,000 men and their equipment, as well as a dummy drop of dummies, with firecrackers and things tied to go off as they were as they were descending. And the interesting sidelight, which I've mentioned in my book, is that the some of the mounting up of the paratroopers into the aircraft that were going to drop them, some of that was carried out at Air Force bases. But one big set of soldiers was mounted up into the transport aircraft at Dum Dum Airport, at Calcutta's international airport. And by that time, it was fairly late in the war, by that time, there were already UN relief aircraft and their crews sitting at Dum Dum waiting for the opportunity to go into Bangladesh and carry out relief operations. There were war correspondents milling around in Calcutta trying to find someone who'd take them into Bangladesh, unofficially by hook or by crook. And some of them saw the paratroopers climbing into the aircraft. And they sent telegram-based articles back to their publications in the West. And they multiplied the number by a factor of about 10. So they wrote wildly inaccurate stuff about how many paratroopers were mounting up, and that somehow or other trickled back to the Pakistan. Pakistanis were monitoring Western news bulletins because they were hoping for help from the West and from the Chinese. And they've been made to believe that the U.S. Seventh Fleet and others would come to their rescue and things like that. So when these inflated numbers started appearing in the Western press, it sort of contributed to the complete breakdown of Pakistani senior commanders' morale. Again, I think it has to be said, Pakistani junior officers and men fought well. It was in no sense a walkover for the Indian Army. Mm-hmm. Junior officers and men fought well. But factors like these,
yeah,
they just broke the morale of the commanders. And when the commander's morale is broken, then you know it trickles down to the men somehow.
Right. So, coming towards the end of this war, so as we all know, the famous 92,000 military personnel who surrendered. I want to ask you, and I have had this question in my mind since the time I got to know about this war. We actually let whoever had surrendered, we let them go. And was that a bad decision in hindsight now?
I think this is something that this again is something that comes up pretty often, and it's often a little the arguments around this are often a little ill-informed, because they claim that we returned all the Pakistani prisoners without getting anything in return, right? Now that's actually not true. The Pakistanis were holding a small number of Indian prisoners born. We got them back, but more importantly, I think what was more important was both the United States and Pakistan were resisting official recognition of Bangladesh as a country. Right? Now, Pakistan's recognition didn't matter, right? But the United States recognition mattered, because the United States could veto the admission of Bangladesh into the United Nations. Right? So the United States denial of recognition of Bangladesh as an independent country was actually hampering Bangladesh very, very severely. And in all the negotiations and all the back and forthing that went on between Mrs. Gandhi and Bhutto on the Pakistani side, as well as a lot of back channel discussions, including diplomats from other diplomats and decision makers from other countries, two of the factors that the US was insisting on to extend recognition to Bangladesh. One of them was, there were several factors that the US was insisting on to extend recognition to Bangladesh.
Yeah.
And one of them was the return of prisoners of war. So I think the return of the prisoners of war was actually, from the larger humanitarian point of view for which we went to war, right? That was actually a good deal, because the return of Pakistan's prisoners of war helped to put Bangladesh on its feet, which would not have happened without the United States finally withdrawing their objections to their veto of admitting Bangladesh to the UN.
Got it. So it was basically a small price to pay for that.
In the overall scheme of things, I think that was I think it was the right decision. It was a price, but I think it was the right decision. And frankly, how much longer could we have kept them? I mean, we'd kept them for more than a year by that time. How much more could we have got by keeping them?
Yeah.
I think I very much think it was the right thing to do, to return them, making sure we got, if not India personally, making sure that the purpose for which India went to war and the purpose for which a few thousand Indians were killed and tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of Bangladeshis were killed was finally accomplished.
Right. So, this war happened around almost 3 decades before I was born. So I had no clue about this till few years back, till I, got into politics and I started reading about all of these things. And specifically for this one podcast, I actually went around my area and I talked to people who are, older. I talked to people who are in their late, maybe 60s, 70s. And there's a temple here and there's a Panditji. He's a very old Panditji. So I was talking to him and he asked me this one very, philosophical type of question, which is, when I asked him about, do you know about the war? What were you doing at that time? So he, by the end of the conversation, he asked me, "Ek fauj ko jang jeetne ke baad kya milta hai?" And I couldn't answer him, because obviously you get decorated, you get all your naam aata hai, newspaper and everything, all of those things. But what does the army get? Because there's a lot of killings happening, you are losing your own men, you are looking at a lot of atrocities. So what do you think Indian Army, what they went through after the war, what was their mindset like? Can you talk about that?
Bas ek jan se fauj ko kuch nahi milta is my first response. एक जंग से फौज को कुछ नहीं मिलता है. आई मीन आई हैव हर्ड अ कन्वर्सेशन बिटवीन बिटवीन टू फौजीज अबाउट दिस हैपेंड आफ्टर टू पीपल हैड बीन इन्वॉल्वड इन अ इन अ इन अ क्रैश. One of them had been killed and the other one had been blinded.
Okay.
So the two Faujis were discussing them and they said, one of them said, you know, sad for the one who died. And the older Fauji said, he'll be all right. He gets a medal and his wife gets a pension. At the best of times, what else do we get?
Yeah.
The bigger tragedy is the young man who's been blinded.
Right, right.
So ek jang se fauj ko kuch nahi milta. There is a story that a lot of Faujis believe that immediately after soon after the 71 war, their emoluments were their pay and emoluments were reduced. Now that is actually arguable. It's not true that they were reduced, but it did happen after the Second World War. The Second World War, India had put 2.5 million Indians into the Second World War. And many of them didn't want to stay in the forge. Many of them left the forge after the Second World War. Some stayed on, but those who stayed on, their salaries were cut. When we became independent, Indian forgie salaries were cut by about 30% or more.
Wow.
And jang se forgie ko kuch zyada nahi milta, boss.
Right.
That is not why they do it. They fight, you know, an old soldier who's, you know, deeply in, you know, involved, they'll say they fight for three things: naam, namak, or nishan.
Right, right.
That's what they fight for.
I've heard this. I've actually asked this question to a soldier and he told me exact this thing. And, you know, we were talking about this thing before we started the podcast, recording the podcast, which was, why didn't India glorify this war? And I would really like to know your opinion on this, because in my, whatever I have read about the Indian Army and the Indian Wars, I think so. This was the only war where India was actually prepared, and clearly we had won. In the other wars, we have won, but there are, you know, as you said, Pakistan ke saath mein hamesha contest hota hai. But here we clearly won, and the whole world saw it. Then why didn't we glorify this war?
Yeah. So I have strong views on that. And I think, why didn't we glorify the war? I think the first thing to say is that we were probably exhausted. We had achieved a victory. The government was exhausted. We had achieved a victory which the victory was bigger than we had thought. I mean, before the war started, we looked at various scenarios and we had looked at scenarios far below this total victory for Bangladesh. We had looked at scenarios of liberating only up to Jessore and setting up a government in exile in Jessore and various other scenarios like that. So this scenario was a bigger victory in some ways than we had than some of the scenarios we had imagined. So it was a big victory for us. We didn't want to get into the the very difficult and challenging activities which making a bigger historical point of this victory would have entailed. And again, since you've read my book, you're aware that one of my thoughts is, suppose we'd set up, you know, there was no International Criminal Court at that time. Yeah. Suppose we had set up a war crimes tribunal with defenders and, prosecutors so that no one in Pakistan could claim that this is victor's justice. If we had gone to the trouble of doing that and publishing the results, I think that would have been a huge, sort of contributed to remembering the war and remembering the success of an essentially humanitarian war, of a war undertaken in pursuit of essentially humanitarian objectives in a way that it has not been. So I think, you know, the Indian government was just too exhausted. We'd won the war. They were sort of a little surprised and, you know, let's not push our luck too far. There was a little bit of that kind of thinking in the government. And also, frankly, 3 years after the end of the war, Mujibur Rahman had been assassinated.
Yeah, the CIA conspiracy.
Many people think Kissinger had something to do with it.
Yeah, yeah.
But Mujibur Rahman had been assassinated and Indira Gandhi had proclaimed the emergency in India.
Right.
Suspending the constitution and civil liberties. Right? So I think that is basically the ferment of politics in India had had pushed Indira Gandhi into, you know, she had been found guilty by a court of electoral malpractice. So she declared the emergency to stay in power. Now, that's basically, I think, a consequence of India's very feverish politics. Right? If we had been able to, if these two things hadn't happened, I think when Mrs. Gandhi declared the emergency, I think she lost a lot of the moral standing which India had achieved through its intervention in the 71, in the Bangladesh, in the liberation of Bangladesh.
Right.
So if these two things hadn't happened, the assassination of Mujib, and which led to a series of military governments in Bangladesh, so which wasn't a good advertisement for the long-term success of the intervention. And Mrs. Gandhi had sort of suspended democracy in India. So right. I think if these two hadn't happened, we would have had a better chance of its being remembered. And you know, the thing is, I think Western countries tend to think of any war in which they themselves are not involved as some incomprehensible tribal dispute, you know, Eritrea, Ethiopia, kisko pata hai, you know, who's in the right and who's in the wrong.
Right.
So they don't bother to figure out who's in the right and who's in the wrong in any war unless they're involved themselves. Right? So we lost an opportunity to establish this war as one of the world's last just wars.
Correct. And, absolutely.
Because primarily of these two factors, I think, the assassination of Sheikh Mujib and the proclamation of emergency by Indira Gandhi.
Right. So I actually, like, you know, wanted to know this from you. And now that I've got the answer, I think so a lot of people need to read this book, especially my generation, because as I said, I was born, you know, almost 3 decades after the war. So this book is like a time capsule for me. You have mentioned your schoolboy, what you were seeing, what you were experiencing. Yeah. So that was actually very special about this book. And one last question, which we ask to every guest that comes on our show, which is any of your, you know, favorite book recommendations. It can be anything about military history or your favorite subjects. It can be any, like, you know, 3 or 5 books that you want to recommend.
Oh, I have lots of you can see the shelves behind me.
Oh wow.
So and I can see shelves behind you.
Yeah.
So lots lots to recommend. I think in the in respect of India's participation in World War II, I think Srinath Raghavan's book India's Wars. It's India's War, singular. Srinath Raghavan, who's one of the best military historians India has produced, he's written a book just called India's War. So that is, I think, one of the best books. It's not an operational story. It doesn't tell about the, so in that sense, it's a little disappointing because it doesn't have the, the stories of, the courage of the Indian, 30 Indians won Victoria Crosses during the Second World War. 30 Indians won. That itself is enough material for a 600-page book, right? But Srinath Raghavan's book doesn't cover that, but it covers a lot about the effect of the war on India and in economic, sociological, social, and all that. So that's, I think it's a brilliant book. Air Vice Marshal Arjun Subramaniam has written 2 books, one of which the title is very similar to Srinath Raghavan. It's called India's Wars, plural.
Yeah, I have read this
book. That covers the wars up to 71. And then he's done another book covering the conflicts we've been involved in after that, called Full Spectrum. So you'll be aware of those.
Oh, I have read both of these books. The second one I read, I think so last month or previously.
Full Spectrum.
That's a brilliant book, yes.
Yes, I think it tells how the warfare that India is facing is changing. Right? It's no longer the kind of set piece stuff that we used to see in World War II.
Right.
Most of the 65 war and the 1947-48 war, the 65 war and the 71 war, most of them can be understood in terms of World War II tactics, except maybe for the use of missiles. But everything else is pretty much the technology and the tactics are World War II tactics all over again.
Right.
But what's happened after 71 is very different. And Air Vice Marshal Subramaniam's Full Spectrum brings that out very effectively. So those are important books. I have to say, I think it's important for us to understand Kashmir a bit better than we do
yeah.
now. And there are some very good books on Kashmir. There's a book by Praveen Swami called India, Pakistan and the Secret Jihad. So okay. that's not entirely about Kashmir, but there are large sections of it that are about Kashmir. And it's a very seriously researched book. It's an academic standard book with footnotes and references
right.
like you'd find in an academic textbook. That's one. And then there's another book which, I think it's a little harder to find, but I think it is there on Amazon. It's a book by Ajit Bhattacharjee, who used to be the editor of the Indian Express. He's written a brilliant book about Kashmir called, I think it's called Kashmir, the Wounded Civilization.
Yes.
Now that
I know about this book.
Well, particularly given, the somewhat less than entirely accurate representations in film about Kashmir these days. I actually think Ajit Bhattacharjee's book is a very important one because it shows you, it tells you how much wider and more complicated the history of Kashmir is than okay. what we're currently being fed. That book was written, I think it was published in the 1990s. So it's not a very, it's not a recent book, but it does cover the period when militancy was at its peak. And I think it really shows how history is not simple. History is not black and white. And I think the Indians are smart people, right? But we are fed a black and white story a little too
often. Yeah.
And I think that needs to change. So these are a handful of recent books which I'd recommend. I'm very keen. I'm looking forward to reading Reet Samadhi, which is
right.
the
Booker Prize. Yeah.
International Booker, yeah. So right. whatever it is, that is, I think, a mark of India's own languages becoming recognized in international literature. And Munshi Premchand would have been so proud.
absolutely.
Yeah.
I would definitely pick up those two books on Kashmir because I come from a journalism background and my final year project was on Kashmir. So I have been studying about Kashmir since past, I think so, 4-5 years now. And I'll definitely pick up those two books because Kashmir is an issue that I really am interested in.
Let me just put in that without making too much of the parallels, I think there are lessons from the Bangladesh war for how we deal with Kashmir.
Right.
Well, I'm not suggesting that we not the war itself, but the So let me nuance that slightly. There are lessons from the lead up to the Bangladesh war, right?
Mm.
From the things that Pakistan did wrong in the lead up before the shooting started, right?
Right.
There are some lessons for us in for how we treat Kashmir.
I think so. That one sentence deserves a completely separate podcast because now I have like thousands of questions. But we'll schedule something once again. I would definitely love to talk with you. This was a brilliant podcast, and I'd just show the book again to the audience. You'll find the link in the video description. Please go buy this book because. Firstly, this is brilliantly written. And I know a lot of people complain that military history can be boring, but this is not. This is absolutely brilliantly written. There are anecdotes. There are his own thoughts, what he was seeing at that time. And obviously the missions and the conflicts, everything is written so brilliantly. So please go ahead, buy this book. And Shri, thank you so much for doing this podcast.
Thank you, Jay, for having me on here. So I really enjoyed talking to you. So.
Beautiful. Thank you.